Well, now the canine tool that is being used to detect kauri dieback in Auckland's Waitakere Ranges, the pathogen is threatening kauri with extinction, starving trees of water and nutrient intake, and it's not known exactly how far it has spread. 4 years ago, the Auckland Council imposed strict measures to prevent the spread, including closing off parts of the Waitakere Ranges to the public. Well, the Auckland Council has just released the results of its 2021 Waitakere Ranges Kauri Health Monitoring Survey. It shows 81% of the trees are in good health or only showing minor signs of stress. Kauri dieback team manager Lisa Tolich says the pathogen that causes the disease has only been found on the periphery of the Waitakere's, which she says is heartening news. Kia ora and welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us, Lisa.
Oh, kia ora.
And also in a moment we're going to talk about another disease prevention measure, which has been the trial of two sniffer detection dogs. It's so far yielded promising results, and now a third dog is being trained up. Auckland Council Biosecurity Advisor Karen Johnson's with us also. Morena, Karen.
Morena.
Lisa, first, can you tell us, please, what you have learned from this latest survey?
As you said before, there's some really positive findings that have come out of the survey. And one of the most important ones is that the pathogen has not been found in the heart of the Waitakere Ranges. So it's very localised in a small number of areas and on the periphery of the park. And this distribution we're seeing is very consistent with that of a slow-moving invasive pathogen, and it hasn't yet achieved its full potential range. So there is much that we can do in terms of intervention to avoid that spread into the heart of the Waitakere Ranges.
However, 81% of trees are in good health or only showing minor signs of stress. That means nearly a fifth are in worse condition. What condition?
That's right. So what we were able to do with this new survey is establish some new monitoring measures. And what we've looked at, or what we've discovered, is that the pathogen itself, Phytophthora agathodicida, its prevalence is 10%. So basically 10% of all soil samples that we took returned that result. We also looked at the symptomology in terms of how healthy those trees were. And the prevalence in terms of that is 16.5%. So those two measures are really important. They provide a baseline, and they also mean that when we go back in future years, we can see whether that changes over time, and we can also measure how successful our management interventions are in response.
Do you believe that prevention measures have been part of keeping it on the periphery of the Waitakere's, or is that more a bit of good luck?
It's probably a little bit too early to tell that, but that is certainly something that we've set this long-term framework up to monitor over time. So we will return probably in 5 years' time, and we'll be measuring basically incidents at that point. And what we have found, though, we actually did three different studies as part of this work, and one of them was looking at risk factors and impact factors for the disease and the pathogen itself. And we found a very strong association between Phytophthora agathodicida, asymptomatic kauri, and its very localised distribution is reinforcing that hypothesis that it is an infectious disease. It's actively spread between hosts, and those measures we've put in place around infectious disease control, so isolation, hygiene, and treatment, should be continued in terms of ongoing strategies in this space.
What is it possible to establish yet what its nature or speed of spread is? As we said in the introduction, there's still a little bit of its leading the way, and we're catching up on understanding. Are you at a point where you're able to understand a bit more about the nature of the spread of this disease?
Yeah, so there's two parts to that. One is that this was very much a baseline study, so we've set ourselves up well for being able to have a far better understanding of that rate of spread into the future. And we're doing that with those prevalence measures. But the other thing it does tell us, though, is when you look at that kind of spatial distribution, so that very localized nature of only finding the pathogen in a small number of quite discrete locations, that's evidence of an introduction point and slow spread out from that point. Assisted both in terms of natural but also human mediators as well. And, you know, that's something that we're going to have to continue to monitor over time.
So what does that tell you about your prevention methods? There's an introduction point. There is a radius beyond that. What more does it tell you about the sorts of measures you need to take with respect to keeping humans or animals under control as much as possible?
So that's absolutely right. What it's telling us is that looking at vector-based management is still appropriate, so that pathway management. We're dealing with a pathogen that is soil-borne. It is found within soil, and the best thing that we can do is to focus on those areas that we can influence. So you're right, that covers a whole range of different things. That's investing in pest management control is really important. It's thinking about the ways that we interact with our forest as well. So thinking about our recreational experience, but it's also thinking about, you know, how carefully we manage those interventions ourselves. Because what we've seen in this study is the associations, the risk factors, were very, very closely associated with disturbance of soil. And some of those are quite historical, looking back to Kauri timber mills and things like that. So those are definitely strong associations and risk factors, but there's other associations that are linked to disturbance too. And one of those was actually seeing the association with Tanikaha. And Tanikaha is very indicative of forest regeneration. So it's all included within those range of factors. They're all interrelated.
So can you explain a little bit more about the last point and its implications?
Sure. So when we're thinking of a big disturbance event, in terms of whether it was something historic like logging or other land fragmentation, so, you know, changing to farming procedures, for example, changing the use of that land, all of those things are disturbance factors. And when a forest is starting to regenerate, you see quite specific species that are almost like proxies for that regeneration, and Tanikaha is one of those.
So this is a conifer, and just explain a little bit more about, again, its role in this.
Yeah, so what we're seeing here, what I'm describing, it's a relationship or an association between when you see high prevalence of the pathogen, we're seeing a strong association between that and the presence of Tanikaha. So what I'm basically saying there is there's a strong relationship between the two. You find the pathogen at sites where you've seen disturbance. Tanikaha is one example of those. The historic timber sites are another example of those. Tracks are another example of those.
Has it been planted?
Tanikaha?
Yes.
So in this case, we're talking about natural
regeneration. It is a native pine, is
it? That's correct. So this isn't a causal relationship. It's not a Tanikaha is here, so therefore the pathogen is here. What it's saying is because Tanikaha occurs quite early on in that regeneration process, it's a bit of a proxy for disturbance.
Okay, so it's evidence of disturbance.
That's right.
Understood.
That's right.
So what does this mean for the tracks that have been closed all of this? Will some reopen? Will some others close? What's it going to mean?
Yeah, so we've got an existing track reopening plan that runs through to 2024, and that's what we're currently committing to. But the survey findings will actually feed into an assessment framework for future track reopenings, and that sits under the context of the regional parks management plan. So there's more recreation planning to happen and to take place. And the findings from the survey, because they're a lot more granular, we can get down to prevalence at a subcatchment level, that is going to feed straight into that plan.
Finally, speaking of disturbance, how do you survey 68,000 trees without being a risk vector yourselves? How's the work done?
That's a really good question. So we can't survey all 68,000 trees for a start. We're fortunate to have that technology now, that remote sensing technology that does allow us to map Cody from the air without boots on the ground. And that's really useful when you're trying to get an estimate of that total population size to start with. When we're sending field teams into the field, we couldn't do all, that entire population. So we had to select what we call a sample frame, which is representative of that population. It includes both healthy as well as diseased Cody, and it's completely random. So when that field team goes in and assesses those randomly selected trees, they're having to take a lot of really specific precautionary hygiene measures. So we're very careful about the time of the year that this work takes place. You wouldn't send them in winter when it's very wet and muddy. We had earlier indications of where risk areas certainly were. So if the team were entering in at different sites, we would sequence it. So you were trying to stay or visit the healthier areas first before you got anywhere near any of the sites that we knew the pathogen was. So that was a sequencing thing. But then there's all the general hygiene measures as well about making sure that all the gear and equipment that's used during this is either clean or kept out of contact with the ground.
Now, Mihi, thanks very much. That's Lisa Tolich, who is the Kauri Dieback Team Manager of at Auckland Council. It's just released the results of its 2021 Waitakere Ranges Kauri Health Monitoring Survey. And the good news is that 81% of the trees are in good health or only showing minor signs of stress. But the good news really is, so far, the disease found on the periphery of the Waitakere Ranges. And you heard in more detail there their theories about the location. Well, Kieran Johnson, listening in, is biosecurity advisor at Auckland Council. And let's talk about another tool here in the fight to try and stave off Kauri dieback, which is the good old canine. Kieran, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Really good, thanks. So these trials using sniffer detection dogs have so far shown some pretty promising results as well. First, how do you train them? What are they out there doing?
So what we're able to do with the dogs is have the Phytophthora agathodista, embedded into soil samples and Cody roots and other types of material for us to be able to train the dogs on. So similar to what Lisa was talking about with hygiene protocols, we have some pretty strict protocols around training the dogs as well. In terms of the room that we use and of going in and out of the room and everything like that. So we train the dogs on samples that have been inoculated for us in the lab. And we do that by teaching the dogs through positive reinforcement. So if it sniffers the Phytophthora that we want it to find, it gets rewarded with our food or toys. And then we build on it from there. And at the moment, our recent trial has tested them against other common Phytophthoras that we might find, and also other random non-target things that we don't want them to indicate on, like distractors like food or something like that as well.
What breeds are you using?
So we have two dogs that we're doing the trials with at the moment, and one of them is an English Springer Spaniel, and the other one is a Yud Terrier, which is a type of German hunting terrier.
We know they're incredible. There is a word for it. Their nasal abilities are just incredible. And can sniff out illness, all sorts of things. Do you have a sense of, or can you explain to us what's going on that enables these dogs to identify a pathogen?
So everything has a smell to a dog. We think of some simplistic things as maybe not having an odour, but to a dog, everything has some type of an odour. And so even something very small, like a microorganism, is still a living being. A disease can still be a living being. So it gives off its own type of odour, releasing gases, or as it lives and thrives in the host that it's in, it would have its own odour. Definitely not the easiest thing. to teach the dogs to find, and it comes with its own complications. But yeah, if you can picture that, everything would have its own smell to the dog. And like you're saying, their noses are said to be, I mean, there seems to be a different number every time you read something. It's 100,000 or 5 million times more sensitive to smell than what ours is. And that's what they use to navigate most of their life. So a lot easier for them to pick up on something like that than us.
Olfactory was the word I was after. And of course, they're used also by customs at airports to pick up on everything from fruit to drugs. So this is simply applying that skill to something else. So how would this be used in practice? And again, as we said, the issue of not wanting the solution to become the problem. If you get to the point where you're going to be able to use them in the field, how would that happen?
So it really comes back to what Lisa was saying before about prevention. That word seems to come up so much within this work. So they are really there to try and be a preventative tool for us. The way that we're using them is the same sort of words again. So look at our pathway management, so how the disease could be spread into areas where it's not already known to be. So we will ideally be using the dogs to screen goods, materials, anything that we think could be a pathway of moving the disease from an area with the disease to an area without it. Some of the areas that we would like to concentrate on are some of our islands in the Hauraki Gulf. Islands like Waiheke don't have Cody Dieback disease, and so we would obviously like to keep it that way. So they'll be a huge part in the if you can think of them as sort of like a screening tool for goods, which we don't really have at the moment. So if we could get them working to a really high sensitivity in that area, it would be a huge benefit.
They're about 70% successful at the moment. What would they need to be to put them in the field?
So I think for us at the moment, 70% has been a great benchmark to start our trials with and work from there. I think as soon as we start to reach about 80 to 90%, would the people that are handling and training the dogs would be really happy with that. 70% is still a good number for us to really start to push them out operationally and see what we can do with them. And that just comes from our first phase of trials. So hopefully within the next few months we'll enter our second phase of trials, and that will give us another number that we can build on and have a better understanding, because that's all it is for us at the moment. It's really trying to understand how this could work for the dogs and where they're best placed, because nobody has done this sort of work with dogs in New Zealand before, so it's just kind of feeling it out and also making sure that we have the most confidence that we can in the dog. As you can imagine, if they indicate on something that the phytophthora is present, we can't see it, so we really have to be able to trust in our training and the dog's abilities.
Do they have names, Kieran?
They definitely have names. So Pip is our English Springer Spaniel, and Marfi is the terrier that we're using. And we also have another younger dog who's another English Springer Spaniel who we've started doing some training with as well, and hopefully he will be able to fit into those trials with us, which just gives us a larger sample size of dogs that we're able to gain more information from.
We'll call him Junior for now, eh? Thanks very much, Kieran Johnson. Thank you.